I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, lordsofpain.net. Wherever you may be listening, Doc says.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast, Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment and of the doctor's orders on lordsofpain.net. Doc says. Hello and welcome to the Doc Says here on the Chair Shot Radio Network. I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, author of The Greatest Matches and Rivalries of the WrestleMania Era, which should be due out on audiobook format any day now. I will confirm for you exactly the details when details become more readily available, but we're close. I know that. It's imminent, so I'm excited about that. I think you'll enjoy it if you enjoy these podcasts. That book's basically many hours of me breaking down wrestling matches and wrestling rivalries, ranking them as I'm prone to do, and doing so in what is as objectively subjective a manner as you will find out there. So that's for another time. Let's focus on last weekend's SummerSlam G1 Climax weekend-ish. I'm kind of going back and starting with Thursday and then letting things play out all the way until Monday with the G1 Climax final. That will leave out what I've heard but have not seen was an incredibly satisfying Roman Reigns versus Buddy Murphy match, which as a 205 live guy, a big fan of the Purple brand, as I always have been, I really think that Buddy Murphy's ascent to SmackDown's been a complete waste of time up until now because he's not gotten the chance to do anything. But the Roman Reigns match, I hear, played to his strengths, gave him the opportunity to showcase what he could do in the ring, and the guy once known as the juggernaut of 205 Live deserves an opportunity on SmackDown to make an impact, so I'll look forward to seeing him do that, but I'll talk about that perhaps at a later time. Lot of wrestling to catch up on. I was actually out of town for the weekend last weekend, and I was traveling during SummerSlam. I was unable to watch TakeOver. I kept up with the latter part of the week's worth of G1 stuff. So actually, on my timeline, it's Thursday. It might actually go all the way back to Wednesday, but we'll put it this way. The final 3 days of the final three sets of matches of the G1 Climax is going to be included in the forthcoming top 10 countdown from the weekend-ish. So before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit about the overall G1 Climax experience, which was really tremendous for me. I can't really say enough good things about it. If you've never done that, if you've never committed the time to following it, then I recommend next year you do that, because it really is a joy to watch. It's the greatest collection of classic wrestling matches that I've ever seen. And it's interesting, it's an exercise in trying to formulate how you feel in the moment about ranking wrestling matches, because it's too deep a roster of classic matches to revisit all of them. I mean, God, I mean, there were like 20 four-star matches in the thing that I shared on lordsofpain.net a few weeks ago, the little blog that I wrote, what must have been like five matches in, looking back at all the great matches that I rated. I mean, it was a substantial list, and it only continued to grow. And I mean, I don't even know that I would have time to go back and add in all the other stuff. I mean, I kept a running log of how I rated everything. But the volume of those matches, trying to break them down and rank and file them, was really challenging because, as you'll hear when I talk about this top 10, there's several G1 matches on it. But trying to rank and file them, that's a challenge because there's so many. And a lot of them are very similar because it's a tournament-style match. It's like if you watched a slate of college football games on a weekend like Labor Day where you have them basically starting on Thursday and going all the way through Monday. If a whole bunch of them are classics, it's hard to really say which one is more classic, so to speak, than another. I've always found that to be an interesting exercise, but for wrestling matches to be produced over a five-week period, that many great ones in one month-long period that's all a part of the same tournament, that's uncharted territory for my reviewing skills. I'll have to maybe think about doing something that reflects that greatness in ranking format down the line, but I would have to come up with some sort of formula to be able to do it. So I loved the G1 climax. I followed it all the way to the finale. I started watching it on night one, and I finished watching it on the final night. And my guy, Kota Ibushi, he won the thing, which was great. I mean, this is in terms of winners of big things in 2019 for my wrestling fandom, Seth Rollins winning the Royal Rumble, winning the Universal Championship, winning it again this past weekend at SummerSlam. You know, that's my guy in WWE. Kota Ibushi's my guy in New Japan. There's a lot of good things going on in pro wrestling, and it just so happens that some of my favorites are ascending to the top of their promotions in the main event scene. And Kota Ibushi, if he ends up facing Okada in a rematch from the A block final, which I'll get to here in a bit, it's definitely a big part of my top 10. Then I think Okada versus Ibushi as the Wrestle Kingdom 14 main event, that sounds great. Kota Ibushi is an untapped main event resource for New Japan Pro Wrestling. It'll be interesting to me to see if they go all the way with him. So, SummerSlam, I thought was one of the best WWE pay-per-views, particularly Big Four pay-per-views, in a long time. I loved its length. I loved that it peaked with a great main event. And the fact that its length was shorter allowed that main event to maximize its crowd response, which is something that is somewhat of a rarity in Big Four pay-per-views today. I did not think that really any WWE Big Four pay-per-view in the More is More era was really all that great, that was really all that rewatchable. But I think SummerSlam 2019 was great and was rewatchable. I didn't see a lot of love for it on the internet in terms of the high-end praise that I'm giving it. But personally, that was my favorite Big Four pay-per-view since all the way back in 2015 for WrestleMania 31. So I think that's the kind of format WWE should consider moving forward. I think that's the formula that they should use. So I'll get into more SummerSlam thoughts here in just a moment, but I wanted to give it overall praise. TakeOver, which is a show that I expected to litter this top 10 countdown with its various matches, it didn't really do it for me, I will admit. It was the last show that I watched, and I thought that it was probably the weakest takeover in a very long time. I'm not going to talk about Gargano against Adam Cole, 2 out of 3 falls again. It's not going to be in my top 10. To be honest with you guys, I haven't watched it yet. I started to, but I couldn't get into it. I mean, I just kind of got the sense from the off that doing this one more time, having the rubber match on a takeover, wasn't going to connect with me emotionally. I loved their second match at TakeOver 25. The first 2 out of 3 falls matches was 47 minutes long. I mean, that's a lot of time to commit to. And I went ahead and checked the runtime for this one ahead of time, and I knew it was 50-some-odd minutes long. And that's just too much for me to commit to after watching all this wrestling. I'm a little wrestling out at the moment in terms of investing in matches, and I wasn't really invested in seeing them go at it at a takeover for a third time. I thought, to be honest, that them in that setting, in that spot for a third straight takeover main event made this takeover feel like an also-ran. I watched the rest of the show. We'll talk about a few of the matches. One that is going to be perhaps alarming by its absence is Io Shirai against Candice Wrestling, Candice LeRae. To be honest, I fell asleep watching it. And it was interesting. Don't get me wrong. I was just really tired. It was one of the last matches that I watched preparing to do this podcast, catching up on everything. We got a lot going on in my world personally right now. So I kind of ran out of steam. And by the time they started into the bulk of their match, I saw some cool moves. I saw some great facial expressions from Io Shirai. I really liked what I saw of her attitude, but this is a match that, quite frankly, I just need to go back and watch again someday. But the other women's match was a real dud. I've never been a big Mia Yim fan, and I did not think that that she really brought the standard that's expected. Bianca Belair, a few months ago, rose up to the occasion and exceeded all expectations. Mia Yim did not live up to expectations of the Women's Championship match at TakeOver. Shayna Baszler's had a lot of really good ones. She's got a formula. Her formula works, but Mia Yim's just not that good. Not in my opinion, anyway. I've never seen anything of her that really was impressive to me, and that dates back to Mae Young Classic's original. I don't watch NXT regularly enough to tell you about that which she does on their weekly TV show, but what I saw at TakeOver Toronto 2 was just not up to snuff. So let's get into the top 10, because all in all, this was a lot of exciting stuff that happened over the course of roughly 5-6 days. I mean, it was a lot of fun to watch all this wrestling. I did run out of gas, but good Lord, it was a blast while it lasted. A couple of honorable mentions from SummerSlam. I was really enjoying what Kofi Kingston and Randy Orton were doing before they went to their non-finish, I guess a count out. I wasn't actually even sure that it was a count out until talking to my buddy Dave Fenichel. He informed me that the ref was counting behind all that drama going on at ringside. To me, it just seemed like the bell rang. But Randy Orton versus Kofi Kingston was a match I was really invested in ahead of time, and I thought that the video package that they put together for that match was absolutely fantastic. So by the time that was done, I was ready and raring to go to see what they could produce. And though it was very methodical, as Orton matches tend to be, I thought that worked in its favor, so that when Kofi Kingston did up the ante with some of the more high-flying tactics, that it popped a little bit more. And I thought they were well on their way to a match that could have contended for a top 10 spot on this countdown, but it just came up short of that expectation because of the flat finish. They did a flat finish last year with AJ Styles versus Samoa Joe, but they let Samoa Joe and AJ Styles pretty much max out what they were going to achieve ahead of time. The finish of that match ended up working pretty well because of the post-match angle. I really didn't feel that way about Orton and Kofi. I'd like to see them get a fair shot to build on what they started. Kevin Owens versus Shane McMahon. Unlike the quite disappointing Styles versus Ricochet match, I thought that Shane versus KO was satisfying and just the right way to book older Shane, who as an underdog scrappy babyface is hard enough to take seriously, but who as a heel, it's just ridiculous, and unless there aren't any rules to break. Taking him seriously is just impossible. His work punches are just ridiculous. He just doesn't have anything there that he brings to the table except for jumping all over the place and crashing through stuff. Kevin Owens took him to task and looked like a star on the rise as a babyface. The show benefited from a cathartic mid-event moment like that, as did Kevin Owens himself. Becky Lynch versus Natty, the submission match. I felt that one deserved a bit of love here, too. It's another honorable mention on account of how intelligently and entertainingly they worked what's really a tough gimmick to pull off without boring fans in a this-is-awesome era that demands traditional false finish in high volume. I was not really looking forward to this match, to be honest, but I was very pleasantly surprised with the effort. It was probably Natty's best ever match. I loved her intensity. At first, what I didn't love was the no rope breaks, but then as they used the lack of rope breaks to elevate situations that otherwise wouldn't have been very dramatic to quite dramatic effect, I became a fan of that booking decision. They swiftly moved across their runtime. I thought that it flew by. They also managed to evoke thoughts of Natty actually winning. as the sharpshooter on the turnbuckle. That was a great spot. The one in the middle of the ring, the sharpshooter in the middle of the ring, it looked so good that it made you wonder how Becky would escape it. So really well done, and surprisingly a good way to start the show. You wouldn't have thought that a match of that type would have been in a position to get the crowd as engaged as it did. Submission matches are tough. They did great with it. That's a feather in both their caps. I think it was the type of match that Becky needed after a couple of months worth of really not doing anything noteworthy or contributing in a way that was actually all that memorable. So let's get to the top 10 countdown. And we're going to start with NXT TakeOver's opening match between the Street Profits and the Undisputed Era. The team of Fish and O'Reilly, they have a track record of producing matches of this caliber. And in the caliber of this match, in my opinion, was really good, but not quite up to the standard of the matches of NXT Tag Team Lore's peak, which include several takeover matches featuring O'Reilly and Roddy Strong. In fairness, Fish and O'Reilly have always teamed during rebuilding periods for the division, whereas Strong and O'Reilly helped spur a post-revival DIY second tag team division peak for the Black and Yellow brand. As for this match specifically, there were some shaky moments to kick off TakeOver Toronto 2. You know, I thought there were a couple of moments where the timing was a little bit off. If the timing had connected a little bit better, maybe I could have pushed this to a 4-star level. But, you know, nothing was too jarring, but the kinds of timing issues that separate goodness and greatness were present in this match. The climactic minutes were very good, though. And any time that a performance can suck you into the point where you are virtually convinced that a fall is coming, only for its potential to go unrealized, separates in its own right very goodness from just merely good. So this was very good. Montez Ford stuck in the Achilles heel leg submission with a splash from Bobby Fish, adding insult to increasing injury, was that moment for this match where it really separated it into that very good category. So well done. Not great, but very good, and certainly worthy of mention on a show like this that's counting down top 10. I thought that it squeaked in there, but it deserved its spot. Number 9 is Juice Robinson versus Jay White from the B Block and the G1 Climax. You're going to hear about Jay White today. There's not a better heel in the business right now than the Switchblade Jay White. And there's not a better young star in the business right now than Jay White. I am fully on board with that guy after watching him answer every question I had about him earlier in the year when he unexpectedly became the IWGP Heavyweight Champion. He's a heel's heel. He is an opportunist. Frankly, he reminds me of the ultimate opportunist, Edge. Against Juice, he relentlessly attacked a knee, and he wouldn't let up. And I thought it was great. Juice, another young gem, and a rare NXT misfire, as CJ Parker, sold the knee injury like a champ, or in so much as selling like a champ is allowed in the world of New Japan, where selling is only so important. By the middle of the match on, you could not help but be sucked into the story of Juice trying to find a way to take down the brash New Zealander, and he came oh so close on so many occasions to turning the tide, before ultimately being felled at the hands of the Switchblade. This match won't make many lists for the best of a very important week in pro wrestling, but I think it deserves to be mentioned. It was an old school match in a new school setting, and it delivered just as much drama as its flashier counterparts, proving that the old school approach, frankly, is still just as effective as ever at one of the primary intents of pro wrestling, which is to make people care. Number 8. Is more of a moment than a match. And that's the debut of The Fiend at SummerSlam, the new incarnation of Bray Wyatt. Look, I agree with Toronto. That was awesome. The presentation was awesome. And it was therefore an awesome thing to see. You talk about Bray Wyatt, and you're talking about someone who had something special that got squandered in some ways. Or maybe you feel like he didn't evolve or wasn't able to keep up with the talent level increase as the decade progressed. No matter the reason, really, the fact is that Wyatt faded quickly after he lost the WWE title in the ill-fated Bugs on the Mat match at WrestleMania 33, and what frankly should have been one of the crown jewels of his career. He's had success in WWE, but I wouldn't call him overly successful, because overall, he's not sustained success like many of his contemporaries, at least not in a way that makes it feel like he lived up to his potential, or that WWE did right by that potential. Either one. The Fiend is a legitimate fresh start, without it being a restart. He's a continuation of the same arc that has been prominently featured at times on WWE TV, and it's always been an interesting arc. It just needed to be evolved as a television character. The Fiend is Bray Wyatt evolved. His entrance remix is a great example of simple tweaks to an existing, relevant character, no matter if said relevance was waning. He looked great at SummerSlam. The whole presentation looked visually stunning, scary enough to want to suspend disbelief, but not to the point where it watched as campy. It looked like something you'd want to give them a chance to see through, because it felt special at SummerSlam, and Wyatt deserves another chance to be special. Watching him demolish Finn Balor, it actually seemed like they created something together, Wyatt and WWE/Vince. They had a lot of fun with it, but had a plan for it that started post-WrestleMania 35, and it had its first successful payoff at SummerSlam. So I'm all in on The Fiend for now. Time for the Wyatt Renaissance. Miz peaked in 2011, remember? Then he faded considerably. We wrote him off. 5 years later, in 2016, he became a major player and has rarely looked back. Tell me Wyatt, who peaked in 2014, can't become a major player again and never look back. Two, also 5 years later. Let him in, folks. Let him in. Number 7. The Velveteen Dream's title defense at TakeOver Toronto 2 against Roddy Strong and Pete Dunne. You know, I don't have a lot to say about this. I thought it was kind of a microcosm of TakeOver. TakeOver was fun, and granted, I mean, I didn't watch its main event, but, I mean, for all intents, from all the people that I trust, it was comfortably the third best in their TakeOver series, and I'm not really all in on third best, especially if I'm being asked to commit an hour to it, from the pre-match video package to the entrances to the match itself to the post-match stuff. I mean, it's literally like a whole hour that you're asking me to spend on the third iteration that seems to be, from all accounts I've read, the comfortably third best in their series. You know, it didn't feel like it needed to progress to that point. So Dream versus Strong versus Dunn, which to me was the match of the night that night, is a microcosm of that TakeOver, because I really didn't think that TakeOver had much to it. You know, it was kind of a weak TakeOver. It's the weakest TakeOver in a very long time, both on paper and in execution. Dream versus Strong versus Dunn was a very fun match with some cool spots. The emotional connection for me wasn't really there like it might have been in a one-on-one scenario, but the appreciation for the enjoyment factor was there for sure. I'd call this a fringe addition to my ongoing NXT TakeOver history countdown that I've been doing for the past year, breaking the matches down WrestleMania-era style. The question for me about its inclusion would revolve around the idea of the fun holding up beyond one watch. As it stands, I thought this was very much worth a watch, but it felt clear to me that Dream was going over, and that this was more just a vehicle to give him a match, though time and booking may prove otherwise. He did very well with his chance, as did the other two. What pushed this to that 4-star fringe level for me was the spot during the climax when Roddy Strong had both guys lined up on the ropes and proceeded to run across their faces with his elbow as if he were playing a game of tag. That was cool. That was innovative. The timing and the execution wasn't perfect in this match, but the creativity was there. In Dream's case, I'd prefer to see him do something more cerebral, because I think that's where he shines brightest. But he'll need to perform well in situations like this triple threat Because I think more often than not, that's the situation he's going to be in when he gets to the main roster. That's just kind of the way it is. Unless you're a tippy-top star, the opportunity to do his cerebral thing that he's so good at, those opportunities just come few and far between. So in that regard, this effort will have benefited him. And the same goes for Dunn and Strong for that matter too, because they might neither one of them ever make it out of the situation in WWE proper where they move beyond wrestling matches like this. So good effort. A lot of fun. Fringe addition to the four-star group that is what shapes the countdown for me. Is that in order to get to be a candidate for that, you got to put on a really memorable showing. You got to give me that four-star kind of effort. I'm not sure that this was that, but it's certainly a candidate for it. So, I mean, well done to those three. It was a lot of fun to watch. Number six, getting a little more serious here. Shingo Takagi versus Tomohiro Ishii from the G1 Climax B Block. Man, this was something. Strong style. I'll tell you, man, it's an acquired taste. Like beer, wine, or spirits. Once you get accustomed to the taste of strong style, though, then you can start to appreciate its finer efforts. There aren't many better strong style vintages, so to speak, than Shingo versus Ishii. Setting the stage for the uninitiated, Ishii needed to win to keep his round-robin tournament hopes alive while Shingo was already eliminated. But Shingo is a transplant from a different promotion still making his name. So his motivation was taking down one of the top 10 New Japan guys. And in my opinion, the clear and obvious true King of Strong Style in Ishii. Regardless of competing motivations, both were highly motivated. Shingo's a freaking beast. Nobody immediately comes to mind as a direct North American comparable to that guy. He's very adaptable with his opponents, though. Ishii makes people adapt to him, but Shingo is just as at home in the ring against Will Ospreay as he is against the Stone Pitbull, which for those unfamiliar basically means he can be Dean Malenko to a Rey Mysterio, or he can be Terry Funk to a Mick Foley, or anything and everything in between from what I've seen. Shingo and Ishii beat the crap out of each other. And I don't mean that in a, they did a whole bunch of high-risk stuff that punched several holes in their respective bump cards type of way. I mean, they slugged each other with forearms and chops and clotheslines. Did the classic strong style trope of no-selling them, popping up instantly from things like suplexes too, and finally collapsed from exhaustion, no longer able to muster up any more fighting spirit. I wasn't even in a very good headspace to watch this when I did, my mind trying to drift off to a particularly stressful dynamic in my clinic last week with a patient unhappy about insurance stuff. Freaking insurance, the giant pimple on the face of American healthcare. But their efforts would not allow my attention to drift very far. A sickening thud or a painful grunt jolting me back into a fiction that felt all too real. It was spectacular, man. That's one of my favorite strong style matches that I've seen yet. Number five, Trish Stratus versus Charlotte Flair from SummerSlam. I get the feeling I liked this a little bit more than most. I thought it was outstanding. History matters to me a lot, as much as it does, if not more so than to any wrestling fan I've ever really encountered in 15-plus years of communicating consistently each and every week with wrestling fans worldwide. Something that, by the way, continues to mean a lot to me. Last week, I talked about the dream match and how overplayed that term was in WWE. But that Flair vs. Stratus was the real deal. It was two top two females in WWE history, the top two females, frankly, in WWE history, going one-on-one when the older half of the equation was still in excellent physical condition and was so good for her time that it would not be crazy to imagine her rising up to the level of the modern generation post-women's revolution. Not crazy at all. In a retirement match, she hit a walk-off freaking home run, did Trish Stratus. A four-star label would certainly fit. How could that have been any better? Because of that question and what I'd consider its obvious answer, I'd hear any argument that wished to rate it even higher than four stars. It had everything. motivated opponents with conflicting accounts of a relevant issue, innovation, character, crowd response, rock-solid execution of sequences performed, well-built and intense drama, near falls that you could easily buy, and the time necessary to make it special. Everything. My buddy Plan likes to say that when WWE does it right, they do it better than everyone else. I think that this is an example. You take someone who connected to the level that... To the level that Trish did with fans like me in the 2000s. I mean, she was a top 10 star in WWE between 2004 and 2006. Feel free to argue me on that. And you add the gravitas that Flair brings to the table already, a period longer than Trish's peak for sure, as reflected in my Women's World Cup final ranking of Flair well ahead of Trish, who was well ahead of the next nearest historical foe. Look at Flair now. Performance-wise, she's an all-time great WWE superstar. Point blank. Classic matches at WrestleMania twice, a SummerSlam classic that will go down as her version of Rock Hogan, the only such instance in women's wrestling history to date, mind you, two iconic women's title feuds, one with Becky, one with Sasha, the first ever women's main event at WrestleMania, take into account her championship track record. I mean, good Lord. Hand to heart, who do you take? Charlotte Flair or Rob Van Dam? How about Booker T? Rick Rude? Think about it. My hat's off, man. I loved that match. Cheesy statement time. I am very happy for those two. They nailed it and proved that such a match can happen. Sprinkle a little nostalgia with the standard bearer and a woman that still got it, and boom. I'm glad young fans like my daughter have that match to reflect on and it be something that can resonate with her, like Hogan's match with Rock allowed younger fans to see, oh, that's what Hulkamania was all about back in 2002. Ladies and gentlemen, young fans and old, that's what I was talking about when I ranked Trish in the top 90 of the WrestleMania era in my original book. And ladies and gentlemen, that is what makes Charlotte Flair the greatest women's wrestler of all time. Hats off to both. Number four, it's the G1 Climax Final. Kota Ibushi, winner of Block A, versus the Switchblade Jay White, winner of Block B. You know, the G1 Final was not what I would have expected 5 weeks ago when that journey began. I must say, what a journey again that it was. You know, my modern wrestling fan experience, speaking specifically of 2019, has been different, to say the least, from my 2017 and 2018 experiences. I entered the void after Jinder Mahal won the WWE title a couple years ago. There's no logical explanation of that happening to me. Not even the expansion into India concept holds up because his title reign lost money there too. That was the straw that broke my fandom's back, and I just never really recovered from it. Well, not yet. New Japan healed my fandom this year, and it created an expectation of something very non-WWE in situations like the G1 Climax Final. Yet I couldn't help but feel like I was watching sports entertainment in White versus Ibushi last Monday night in the G1 Final. It was the archetypal heel versus babyface match, the former cheating like crazy and trying every underhanded tactic he could from the outset, and the latter the consummate protagonist. Thinking deeper, I wonder how injured Ibushi was throughout the G1, and I wonder that maybe he had little choice but to power through the ankle sprain suffered on match 1 of 10 matches, because he was booked to win the whole thing. On the surface, Ibushi's matches were not wrestled at his peak level of athleticism, and he was not his typical daredevil self. The more reserved version still got the job done and left the door open for some pretty epic matches. Only his match with Ospreay a few weeks ago, though, cracked the top 5 to 10 of the tournament for me. I could make a case for this match or the one with Okada for the top 10, but not the top 5. Storytelling in the G1 final, though, was sublime, and that's what made me feel like I was watching more of a WWE match. The crowd response I heard was certainly only equaled but never topped from what I've watched from New Japan dating back to 2012. The support that White's total command of the moment as a villain garnered for Ibushi, who is such a natural babyface. I mean, think Ricky Steamboat's natural heroic charisma combined with evolutionary Shawn Michaels-type athleticism. I mean, Ibushi, you know, that whole dynamic, I mean, the command that Jay White had was one of the most memorable things about the G1 experience for me. And so it felt like I was watching a type of situation that I love, produced by a company I'm not used to seeing it from. Granted, I mean, I breathe with the Switchblade. I've become a huge Jay White fan. So I know his matches are laced with interference from Gato and cheap tactics, but this felt like a situation that relied more heavily on it and didn't have, as in the previously mentioned White versus Juice match, the unpredictable dynamics to boost the drama. This was straightforward. This was a Ibushi better blanking win here, or this will kind of suck, knowing all the while that Ibushi probably would win here because the situation perfectly set that up, and anything less would have frankly been out of character for New Japan. So to their credit, to Ibushi and Jay White's credit, they told this story near perfectly. So looking like Okada Ibushi again in the Dome? Yes! That's what I've wanted since Ibushi signed that contract earlier in the year. Number 3. Evil versus Okada from the A Block. This was a late last week kind of deal. And what elevated this over me wanting to include things like Ospreay versus Tana, which I haven't watched that yet. I saw it make some lists that were, it was pretty prominently high up, some lists. I read it was an outright classic, adding that to the list of Ospreay classics. So I will go back and watch it. But the one thing it didn't have that I really needed to invest in was stakes. Both guys were already eliminated when that match took place, so it didn't really resonate with me. But Evil versus Okada, there was a scenario there that could have found Evil pulling even with Ibushi, and his match with I can't even remember who he faced in that final night. But Evil, if he'd won here, then he would have gone on and had a shot to claim ultimate victory, because he would have had wins over both Okada and Ibushi. So here's the deal. This one is one of my personal favorites from the whole G1 tournament. Arguably the best wrestler on the planet in Okada against one of the quiet MVPs of the whole G1 climax this year in Evil. So given 25 minutes plus of bell-to-bell time, wasn't the expectation from them something absolutely fantastic? It was for me. Evil was within striking distance of winning this round robin tournament. For those of you that aren't that familiar with the G1 climax, it's basically New Japan's souped up Royal Rumble. So this match in the moment had tangible stakes that translated into a riveting climax that found yours truly, literally rooting out loud. Something I rarely do for anything, unless it's Notre Dame football games. So, I mean, I was really rooting for Evil to win because he made me that big of a fan of his during this tournament. He might have actually moved into my top five guys in New Japan with his G1 slate of incredible matches. Seriously, the guy just kept knocking it out of the park. And he's so unique. I love his in-ring entrance with the colorful take on the Grim Reaper. And I especially love his signature grab a leg, throw it over to the ref or ringside bystander so that they'll catch it and I'll hit you with a huge strike type thing that he does. I think it's awesome. He's a baller. Okada is basically well set up in New Japan to play John Cena kind of role. I truly do appreciate Okada, but I'm not someone who roots for him. I very frequently find myself wanting him to lose. He's got a true knack for making you think he might lose because he sells so well. And he has awesome facial expressions, so it's easy to get emotionally invested in his matches. He's the total package, folks. Those unfamiliar owe it to their wrestling fandoms to see what all the fuss is about with Okada, because there just aren't many on his level, if any, and that's pretty much ever. Nevertheless, He is establishment now. He's the ace. He's the man. Guys like Evil, who are but a step away from being consistent top-tier guys in New Japan, could make beating him their meal ticket. But Okada is the Patriots. He's Man City. So you've got to earn the right to beat him by getting over and killing it in the ring consistently. Evil did that in the G1, and he's to be commended for it. So take stock of all of that. You have the Okada is Cena, so I want him to lose dynamic. You have the Evil just had the Dame Lillard performance of this year's G1 dynamic. You kind of just want him to keep it going for another night, like you maybe wanted the Trailblazers to keep it going in the NBA playoffs when they made the conference finals. You have the inherent drama of the tournament point system. Okada on 12 points, Evil on 8 with this match and one to go. So if Okada loses to Evil and then Ibushi and Evil win, then there's a three-way tie with Evil owning wins over both. They made it feel possible. So to me, how does this not get into the top five? To you, if you've seen it and all else, prove me wrong. The race for number one, it was a tough call, to be honest, because it was basically, it came down to the defining efforts of the weekend, and it came down to those defining efforts between my two of my favorite wrestlers in the game today. Number two is going to go to Okada versus Ibushi. The A-Block final was probably the match that I was most emotionally invested in heading into the extended wrestling weekend, because Ibushi is my favorite wrestler in New Japan, and I'd very much like to see him main event Wrestle Kingdom next year. It felt like one of the biggest matches of the year on account of Okada's status and Ibushi's top-end potential now that Kota has signed on long-term with New Japan, who I think purposefully prior to had guarded itself against pushing Ibushi too high without that contractual guarantee. So here's the deal. I don't think any match eligible for this list benefited more from the quality of unpredictability. Some overrate that quality, whereas I call it an intangible, because it isn't necessary for a story on the 20 by 20 foot canvas to be great. Here's the thing, though. In New Japan, it probably is a necessity, but so much so that you don't even have to identify it unless it's a special occasion. As I've said before, pro wrestling is sport in Japan, so unpredictability has to matter to make it interesting. They know that, they've built that in, and it's one of their unwritten rules. Still, when you've got Okada looking to add another layer to his substantial resume, he's already the greatest IWGP heavyweight champion of all time at the ripe old age of, what, 30? And you've got Ibushi looking to ascend to that Naito, quote-unquote, I'm not Okada or Tana, but I want my shot at joining them level, then you have a special instance of unpredictability being a primary, tangible reason for the match's success before the bell even rings. I thought they leaned on that, and in doing so, also appeared to hold something back, which makes sense given what their match could be with months of hype behind it and the IWGP title on the line in the dome. Best match of the year? It had the potential to be that. It was not. It didn't reach that level athletically. But they whet the appetite for something greater down the road. Nevertheless, it told a heck of a story. It was almost as if Okada didn't really think Ibushi was on his level, and Ibushi himself had to build belief as the match wore on too. New Japan demands an epic level of greatness in this day and age, and I believe they can reach that level someday, but what they did here was help set the stage for that. Emotionally, this was one of my favorites of the year. All that time wrapped up in watching the G1 climax step by step, and in the story particularly of Ibushi chasing down legacies combined for a thrill ride on Saturday night last weekend, and really is a tremendous match. But number one for me goes back to my WWE roots. It's not going away, my WWE fandom. They are to pro wrestling what Notre Dame is to my football. And, you know, maybe I think that WWE has been on a mid 1980s leading up to Lou Holtz taking over the Notre Dame program type run, the Jerry Faust era of WWE equivalent, so to speak. But that fandom's not going anywhere. And when WWE is good, when WWE gets it right, they're still my favorite. Seth Rollins versus Brock Lesnar. I'm not going to pretend that this was the purely best match of the weekend-ish, because I don't believe that it was. Frankly, I think Evil versus Okada was the best of the kind of wrestling that I most prefer to watch. Nevertheless, what Rollins and Lesnar did was strike at a core issue in WWE over the past few years. And it was a hard strike that the best pure striker in WWE history, The Undertaker at the illustrious peak of his infamous streak within the streak, could have been proud of. You see, it is not 2007, folks. It is not 1990 blanking 8. It is not 2013 or 14 or 15. It is 2019. Seth Rollins, Roman Reigns, Kevin Owens, Charlotte Flair, Becky Lynch, AJ Styles, Kofi Kingston, Bray Wyatt, Andrade, Finn Balor, The Miz, Sasha Banks. These are the top stars of this generation, and they can produce at a level on par with past generations if they are given the proper chance. Seth Rollins conquered Brock Lesnar clean to end a wonderfully told story about a guy who's trying to lead his generation into a future where he and his brothers and sisters that populate the discussion for this era's biggest stars can get a real shot at forging their legacy. They don't want to be remembered as the generation of top stars that couldn't break through the part-timer reinforced glass ceiling, the material with which it was built, designed with Brock Lesnar's face on the logo. They want to be remembered like Shawn Michaels, Edge, Steve Austin, Mick Foley, Batista, John Cena, and CM Punk will be remembered with reverence, but without asterisk. Rollins beating Lesnar this time wasn't just a moment. We get lots of freaking moments. Moments are overrated, and they're overrated because if the guy's creating the moments, if the girl's creating the moments, are capable of creating even bigger ones, then they should be out there executing the biggest moments possible, manifesting memories that echo throughout eternity by putting those moments at the end of great matches, because that's what this generation does better than anyone else. Moments ring hollow when they don't culminate in the optimization of talent. Goldberg squashes Ziggler over and over and over again in a never-ending, tone-deaf overextension of what was needed. Who benefits from that? Who benefits from washed-up Taker meandering through his greatest hits for the 10th time of this year? Nostalgia is overrated. Rollins beating Lesnar at WrestleMania was a moment. You look back on it. You look back on the Lesnar cash-in in July 2019, and you put a match like Lesnar versus Rollins at SummerSlam at the end of it, and the context changes. Since 2015's Royal Rumble Triple Threat, referenced last Sunday when Rollins splashed Lesnar through the announce table, there has been massive potential for a scrappy but incredibly resourceful Seth Rollins. I'm talking HBK-esque resourcefulness, Bret Hart levels of guts and fight and creative ways to beat you in a feature-length match, in a feature-length beast mode match against the Beast himself. It was an instance at SummerSlam of something just working. The people were like me, I think, in Toronto when it started. Aware of the potential, but only mildly interested because it promised to be more like Balor versus Lesnar, an empty and ultimately meaningless yet all the while rock solid but also very forgettable version of Lesnar's signature match. And then, of course, it would end with Lesnar retaining the title with the Rollins potential as Universal Champion completely squandered, an albatross named Baron Corbin to perhaps always be the legacy of the Rollins title reign in 2019 if he had lost to Brock and moved away from the red belt scene. But then belief came quickly with the first curb stomp. And then he kept getting up, and he kept fighting back, and doing it in a way that the people could believe in, because contrary to this ridiculous narrative that Rollins isn't a good babyface, when he in fact has the most logical, natural babyface story arc of any character in the post-reality era, Rollins is actually fantastic in the ring at against any opponent, making you think that he's got a chance to win while fighting from the knees up. The progression across the run time was not substantially better than it was in the Balor match, but it was superior to the progression during the Sloppy Styles match, though it wasn't on the level of the Punk match from 2013. It was the best Brock Lesnar match in 4 or 5 years, right there in the class of the WrestleMania 31 main event. That means something. It means something that Seth Rollins did that. By the way, since calling him the architect of the best SummerSlam resume of the 21st century last year before SummerSlam, he's added this match with Brock, an upper-tier all-time SummerSlam headliner, and the best IC title match in 20 years at a pay-per-view famous for IC title matches. Seth Rollins is the man again. Nothing could have made me happier this weekend than my guy winning back the title and a memorable classic from that big vanilla gorilla idiot who won't go away. So damn it, SummerSlam, thank you. You renewed a little bit of my faith in my favorite wrestling promotion. Hats off to the G1 climax, as it was amazing, but hats off to Seth Rollins being the Universal Champion again. Let's move on. Let's put Brock Lesnar either out of his misery in WWE or in a special attraction role where he belongs, nowhere near the blanking title scene, and let's get the new generation back to the forefront at the top by themselves so that they can build their legacy, because that is the only damn thing that is going to change WWE, is the modern talents being given a fair shot to become legendary. There you go. Thank you for joining me for this Top 10 Countdown, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed the show today. A little bit longer than normal, but a show I think that warranted it given all we had to discuss. Speaking of discussion, hit me up at the Doc LOP on Twitter, and let's talk about the best matches of the G1. Let's talk about the legacy of Trish versus Charlotte. Let's talk about just how high can we rank Rollins versus Lesnar in the match of the year discussion. Let's talk about NXT TakeOver, because I think NXT as a brand is in an interesting spot. I don't know about you, but I didn't hear a particularly amped up Toronto crowd at TakeOver. I think there's some things going on underneath the surface in pro wrestling right now with the rise of AEW that might be affecting the black and yellow brand. Maybe that's a discussion I can bring someone on to have with me on a different day. But your next audio prescription for all things pro wrestling will be next Sunday, so check that out. I'm going to be going back in to the time machine and reviewing WWE in 2012 as a part of my ongoing decade in review series. So top storylines, most underrated, most valuable mid-card match, most valuable mid-card wrestler, all those categories, including a breakdown of the top 10 matches. That's coming next week. So check that out. Thank you again for joining me today. Check out all of the shows here on the ChairShot Radio Network. And don't forget to hashtag always use your head. Take care, guys.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on radio. This is the prepare for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast. Chat, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania